3, 2, 1, fire.
Welcome to 360 Documentaries, stories about people, places, and ideas. I'm Brent Clough. In the last 40 years, cancer has become more than a disease. It's become the enemy. In the popular imagination, we're at war with cancer, and we keep being told that the great victory over it is just around the corner. A lot of this battle language is used by fundraisers who are working in a competitive charity market as well as the medical profession. In Cancer as a Battleground, Sophie Townsend looks at the reasons we've come to feel like a war on cancer makes sense and how that war affects the real people dealing with the disease.
A beautiful Sydney day at the cricket. Normally, the most pink you would see would be from the people who've forgotten their sunscreen. But today, all around the ground, there was a sea of colour.
It's a pink toga. It's beautifully wrapped.
Pink ribbons, yellow daffodils, blue face paint, and brightly coloured t-shirts. It's a rainbow of hope in the battle against cancer.
I'm wearing a pink singlet that I got from Bonds. It's helping ladies in hospital.
My aunt died of lung cancer, and watching her made me think about what the battle against cancer really means. We know more about cancer and what it does to our bodies than ever before. But in all the knowing and in all the battling, are we just running scared?
Originally, when I had the cancer, I had a very, very large tumour and it had gone to my lymph glands. And I remember making a pact and thinking, if only I can see Oscar make it to high school, I'll be happy. If I can make that 5 years, that'll be great. But of course, once you make the 5 years, you get greedy, you want more. I start to think, oh, now I want to see Dominic make high school. And maybe I will. I hope I will, but the likelihood is that I won't.
People who want to give.
We thought we'd come out and show our support, give some dollars to the foundation and hoped everyone else got into it, so, yeah.
It's great. Real men wear pink, isn't that what they
say? My poor mother, who went through hell at the time, she came to visit me one day and I had something like 220 steel staples holding my neck and head together. I hobbled down in the reception area to get some fresh air with her, and there were children about 5 and 6. And the little girl said to her brother, she pointed and said, "Look, it's Frankenstein." And my poor mother burst into tears. I thought it was rather funny.
Look great, I'm a bit of a fan of pink men. Get to show their feminine side.
I'm Stuart Matra. My wife, Angela, died from lung cancer 2 years ago, but before that, about 21 years before that, she had breast cancer as well. And when she developed lung cancer, she really felt that that was unfair. And she would ask everybody, why have I got lung cancer when I'd already had breast cancer 21 years before? Why?
Yeah, my name's Robert McHugh. I first contracted cancer 2001. I had it fairly severely in the right side of my neck. I was hospitalised for 5 months, recovered, got cancer again in 3 years later, 2004, and spent almost 10 months in hospital a second time. And again, I'm in remission. It's strange though, I'll say something about getting cancer. You lose your identity overnight. You know, I went from being Rob McHugh, stand-up comedian, Rob McHugh writer, Rob McHugh, ex-drunk, Rob McHugh, champion pool player, whatever, to Rob with cancer. With cancer. Cancer.
The war against cancer isn't just fundraising jargon. When my aunt had lung cancer, she chose to battle. And we, her family, became her willing foot soldiers. even though most of us knew deep down she wouldn't make it. Dr. Frank Bennett is a palliative care physician in Sydney. His job is to help his patients as they face the real prospect of death, often after months or years of cancer treatment.
I guess the sense of suffering, where a deep sense of despair can lead people to, is terrible. So it's perhaps sadness in this context may be the most natural and human response to what is going on, the most natural and human response. So it's not something that we necessarily have to shift or take away, or we're not trying to do the impossible. And I think that we need to be very careful that the natural physical aspects of what's going on and for a dying patient are treated well, but the natural emotional depth of what's occurring is acknowledged. You will have a patient who is very angry and very upset by the prospect of dying or the prospect of a life interrupted, and particularly a life that's so fulfilling or so busy and so rich. It can be that the patient themselves is more tranquil and that the relatives are more disturbed or more troubled.
My name's Kate Mahon. I developed breast cancer 5.5 years ago and had treatment for a year with cancer, and I just made the 5-year mark in August last year, and that very same week that I made the 5-year mark, I developed a brain tumour, or was diagnosed with a brain tumour. I was given a very bad prognosis and I wasn't going to go ahead with the treatment because I didn't see the point in going ahead. And I had pretty much made up my mind about that because they'd only given me 2 months to 2 years to live. And I hadn't been through cancer before, chemo and radiotherapy and 5 different operations. I thought, what's the point? I'd rather just stay as I am and enjoy that time with my children and husband. So I decided not to go ahead with the treatment. And I was discussing that with my husband one night, late. What I didn't realise is my son, Oscar, the elder one, was sitting on the stairs and he overheard everything. I heard him scurry up the stairs and he was crying in his room. And he said, how can you possibly not have the treatment? Why not? Why do you care about losing your hair? And I want you alive. In that moment, I decided I would have the treatment just for him, you know, and I didn't want to do it at all. But I did. And I suppose that's now, oh, maybe 8 months ago. I'm still here. And I suppose now I'm glad I've had the treatment. Now it's over with, but he really made me do it.
A doctor at the hospital, I think he said that it's possibly lung cancer, and she said to him, so what is the longest you've seen someone survive with this kind of thing? He said, it was a very nice guy who said, well, you know, you don't want to really just go on, you know, there's no real answer to that, but I've seen people go for up to 10 years. And she said to him, okay, if you've seen someone who's lasted 10 years, that's how long I'm going to last. I can tell you now, that's what I'm aiming for. Which is kind of a very sort of positive thing to be saying at that stage, but it's positive from a position of not knowing any of knowing anything about it.
In California, medical researchers are hailing as a breakthrough a new method of treating brain tumours.
The remodeling of the tumour environment helps now to get these immune killer cells into the tumours to actually kill the tumours off.
This is a world-first breakthrough in the fight against cancer. It's certainly on the road to finding a cure for cancer and significantly up the road, and I congratulate you for that as well.
Researchers at Monash University have found a way to revive the thymus, the central organ which manages the immune system.
In some ways, a battle with cancer seems to make sense. After all, Cancer cells are at war with the rest of our body, and what's worse, they're traitorous. Our own cells turned against us. Professor Miles Little from Sydney University.
Cancer isn't really a defined disease until pretty well into the 19th century, when the pathologists, particularly the German pathologists, started to identify the cellular structure and behaviour of different kinds of cancer and realised that there was a commonality to them, because instead of behaving like normal tissue from which they grew, cancers invaded the surrounding tissue and they spread. They spread from their original site through the lymphatics and through the bloodstream and took over other parts of the body. So the surgeon proposes to use the knife, the sword, to destroy cancer. The physician wants to use chemicals, and the radiotherapist will use radiation. It perpetuates the battle metaphor. You automatically start to use metaphors that still have that war, that battle content. We're going to fight your disease by using chemicals. We're going to fight your disease by using radiation. I point out that these are two weapons that are used in modern warfare, and particularly since the Second World War, radiation has become a major fear with the atomic weapons.
You know, the reason I felt so sick with the chemotherapy, he says, but they were actually trying to kill me. He says, but the cancer dies a week before you do, and then we hit the brakes.
So the chemo was awful. I don't think anything can ever describe how bad that is. Whatever they say, it is like that. It's horrible. When I had the radiotherapy, that was like a walk in the park. That was a breeze. People talk about that as being horrendous when you've got breast cancer, but I found after having the chemo, I felt like I was on a holiday almost, even though I was sunburnt from it and, you know, it was very painful. It didn't worry me that much, which is why when they told me I was having radiotherapy for my brain this time around, I was initially very, very pleased, because I thought, oh, that's a relief. I had no idea that it would be so different to when I had the breast cancer, because having radiotherapy on your brain is a much different ballgame to having it on your breast. And I didn't expect to lose my hair from it, but of course everything was burnt, so I lost all my hair. And that was just another horrendous blow, you know. I couldn't even wear a wig because my head was so burnt. I couldn't even sleep. I couldn't put my head on the pillow. It was so hard, you know, difficult. So I wasn't given the choice then of wearing a wig.
Real biological weapons are used against cancer cells in the bodies of sufferers like Kate. But in 1971, the American government stepped in to create a full-scale war, both real and symbolic, against the disease. The war against cancer was born.
I will also ask for an appropriation of an extra $100 million to launch an intensive campaign to find a cure for cancer. The time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
The metaphor kicks around amongst people in an informal way, but very like the war on terrorism, when Nixon or someone like Nixon tells us that he and his administration are prepared to declare war on cancer, I think it gives a tremendous amount of focus. It gives a focus for people to discuss their own battle with cancer, and I think it also gives a focus for finance, for raising money for the war against cancer. It makes it official.
I was feeling my breast, and there you were.
I had brain cancer.
I had leukemia.
I have prostate cancer.
I have stage 4 breast cancer.
I crossed the survivor line, and I got my yellow rose, and I fought you.
You started this.
But we are going to finish it.
Sometimes you just have to pick a fight.
I'm going to pick a fight with you.
Game on, cancer.
Game on.
Game on.
As a possible distraction from the disastrous Vietnam War, President Nixon vowed to pump vast sums of money into the treatment of cancer.
Appropriation of an extra $100 million.
$100 million. Vietnam forever changed the way we think about war. TV cameras showed us the reality of battle in a way that made us more thoughtful and more rigorous about the truth.
I had brain cancer.
I had leukemia.
I have prostate cancer.
But we don't question the war on cancer. Without debate, we celebrate the lives the war on cancer has saved, the money it's raised, its success in getting us closer to a cure. And without this debate, the public participates in a way that recalls an earlier, more naive attitude to war.
100 Japanese bombers raid Singapore on the morning of January the 21st.
There's real hope this gene could stop at least some of those killers, such as colon, prostate and brain tumours.
Japan strikes on a 3,500-mile front from Rabaul to Singapore. Her troops practiced in the arts of war which know no rules.
Scientists have opened up a new front in the war on cancer. The strategy hinges on a gene controlling the blood vessels that allow cancers to thrive.
Even with our more recent distrust of warfare, there's something that feels real about the war on cancer, a sense of urgency and momentum. News of medical breakthroughs unite us to fight. And suddenly, it's not enough to give our spare change to cancer charities. We start to run, swim, bake, grow moustaches, host barbecues, have girls' nights, and play golf, all to win the war against cancer.
The Pink Ribbon Breakfast gives you the chance to support the National Breast Cancer Foundation and have a laugh along the way.
That's why we're going to wear a yellow armband for the Cancer Council's call to arms.
If you think the one in two who gets cancer is one too many, then please buy a daffodil on Daffodil Day.
Tonight I stand here, another individual living with cancer, who asks that we not wait any longer. And I ask only one thing of you. Will you stand up with me? Will you stand up to cancer? So we'll be right over there waiting for your call.
For after all, you know that you're investing in the best. Till the labs come back again, back the old attack again. Bye, 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 bye.
It's done with the best of intentions, but the talk of battle turns inward, into the bodies and minds of cancer patients themselves. My aunt did everything she could to battle her cancer. She tried all treatments on offer, chemo, radiation, special diets, vitamins. She was desperate to live despite the prognosis. It felt to her that dying was just giving up.
There is a strength, clearly, in fighting, in the image of fighting, yourself as a fighter. And that's very similar to the kind of spirit of the Anzacs, the general spirit of patriotism that you see in the United States after September 11. It unites people. It gives them a chance to come together with a common experience, and it gives them a chance to construct a form of hope. I see no problem with that. where it is a problem, it starts to happen when people are told that it's required of them.
Pack up your troubles in your old kid bag and smile, smile, smile.
Cancer sufferers are told to think positively, to even see their disease as a life-changing gift. If patients just banish negative thoughts, look at the bright side, survival is more likely.
It never was worthwhile. So pack up your troubles in your own.
She decided, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get the conventional medicine people to do whatever they can to make me right. I'm going to go with that and I'm going to just believe in whatever they do, and then I'm going to try and do alternative things as well, because I'm going to beat this.
Because what's the option? As I said before, there's no courage or valour in this thing. It's just, you've got no option. If you wallow, you're a dead duck. If you start thinking, okay, I'm not going to get over this, guess what? You probably won't.
They did say that they thought that people who were more positive lived longer. And I do think they do it for, they're wanting people to be positive, because there's a lot to be negative about.
But equally, like all good things, it can potentially start to cause trouble. And the trouble can be in the sense that then people feel, if they're not perpetually feeling positive, that they're letting themselves down or letting their families down or letting the doctors down. As human beings, we're susceptible to all thoughts and all emotions, and no positivity is going to stop us from dying.
How is Mark with this?
He's very positive. He's a very blue sky kind of person, and he will not listen to the fact that, you know, I may not live very long after this. He won't accept that, and he insisted that we have several opinions about it, so hoping that I could get a better prognosis than 2 months to 2 years. He just won't believe that. He's been very supportive, but he doesn't want to look at what I see as the reality.
When Angela was sick, bad towards the end, I'd be going, oh, I reckon you're better today than you were yesterday. And I reckon yesterday you were better than the day before. So I reckon the trend is up. Now, it seems impossible, but then I think after saying that, I sort of later in the day, I went, so what's the trend? Let's just move that trend out a little bit to say, rather than say 2 days, let's make it over 2 weeks. And you just went, oh my God, who am I kidding here? This is just ridiculous. There's obviously the trend is sharply down, and somehow I'm thinking it's somehow some bit of it's up.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer.
The evidence for saying that positive thinking prolongs life is really not very good. In fact, rather to the contrary, it probably doesn't affect survival. It may affect the quality of your life, but whether you can learn to be a positive thinker if you're not, that by nature is another matter altogether.
Yes, we really hit our target for the night. How we sing as we limp through the air.
When I hear people say that they feel glad that they got cancer, that it gave them something else, you know, a focus in life or whatever, I'm shocked when I hear that. I could never, ever say that I feel glad that I've got cancer. I don't know why people say it makes them more positive or it's a blessing or whatever. To me, it's not a blessing. It's an absolute curse and a nightmare.
No positivity is going to stop us from dying.
We love war stories and we admire their heroes, their courage, valour and glory. In the war against cancer, there are heroes too. Increasingly, as we look to celebrities for a sort of moral direction in our everyday lives, there's also a hunger for stories about how they fight bravely through cancer. Some survive, some die. But we look to them to see how it's done.
For the millions who followed Jade Goody's meteoric rise, few would have suspected it would end like this. She died at just 27, struck down in her prime, after a very public battle with cervical cancer.
Jade Goody was loathed when she was made famous as an English Big Brother housemate. She was seen by many as just an uneducated, loudmouth racist. Then she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. All of a sudden, she was wise and brave and good.
The sizeable deal she struck meant some security for the two sons she leaves behind, but also for cancer charities, as her dying wish was to make a contribution.
Even the playing out of her death in public was given an heroic spin.
And I just think she's done an amazing job. You know, it was too late for her, but hopefully she's helped a lot of people.
Through TV, blogs and magazines, we feel an intimacy with our cancer heroes. But you don't always see the reality when the media is looking for the best headline and the most exciting sound grab.
Well, she's very young, very beautiful and very, very successful. Delta Goodrum, at the age of 20, skyrocketed to musical fame, endured a battle with cancer.
For me, while I was going through it, I couldn't wait to go for a walk and get a hot chocolate somewhere. It was like, wow, I'm just lying here going, God, I can't.
Been diagnosed in the early stages and her family and friends are hopeful that after immediate treatment, Kylie Minogue will be able to proceed with the Australian tour.
The moment my doctor told me,
tour, which had been
I went silent.
In Sydney this week. That tour has been postponed, but
my mum and dad were with me.
Back on stage again soon.
Then we all fell to pieces.
Kylie Minogue arrived in Melbourne on the weekend ahead of her Australian Showgirl tour, which was due to open in Sydney on Thursday night.
You've got to fight it.
It felt like my body was a battleground.
For more than three decades, Olivia's been delighting audiences around the world.
I never, however, said, why me? Because I thought, why not me? You know, so many people go through that, and I never had that feeling or, you know, I wasn't victimized by it in any way. But I did feel that this was going to be some kind of life lesson.
Does watching and listening to their cancer stories make us any wiser? Is celebrity cancer a distraction from real life, life and death? Part of the problem with creating heroes is that a hierarchy of heroism is created. Just like the public perception of Anzacs and Vietnam veterans, we've begun to see sufferers of some types of cancer as more sympathetic than others. Surrounded by a public sea of breast cancer pink, my aunt felt envious that as a lung cancer sufferer, she was much lower on the hierarchy of public sympathy. After all, she was to blame for her cancer, wasn't she? Breast cancer charities have raised huge amounts of money for sufferers and have done enormous good. The problem is that the charity market is competitive, and sufferers themselves have been drawn into that competition. When someone like my aunt, a woman who was dying of a terrible disease, feels such shame and isolation, perhaps we're doing something wrong. On the other side of this divide, there are women with breast cancer who feel that they can't possibly live up to the image of their heroes.
One of the most objectionable advertising campaigns that I know about that's gone on within the cancer sphere has been the identification of cancer heroes. And while it's been possible to find plenty of cancer heroes who've had things like Hodgkin's disease, which has a very high cure rate, it's been exceptionally difficult to find people with lung cancer who can be called lung cancer heroes. Those campaigns are good for raising public awareness, they're good for attracting money, but they're terribly tough on people with the cancers, because Pancreatic cancer, for example, has a very, very low 5-year survival rate, let alone long-term cure rate. Trying to find somebody, and there is one prominent person who's had pancreatic cancer and survived for more than 5 years, trying to find someone like that is very difficult. For the great majority of people, this is a promise that can never be fulfilled. If you have pancreatic cancer, the outlook is terrible. But there's this hero out there. So it makes very public the fact that it's possible to survive with pancreatic cancer, but you're not going to do it. And I think the feeling of dissatisfaction, of envy, of guilt, of failure can be very, very serious.
Cancer is a disease that is mysterious, headstrong, and makes its own rules. And mine to this date is incurable.
These raw and honest words are part of Farrah's story. The documentary chronicles Farrah Fawcett's battle with cancer. Fawcett is the longtime love of Brian O'Neill, who opened up to Meredith Vieira in a profoundly personal interview Wednesday on the Today Show.
I know this, that in the last 2 years I love her more than I ever loved her. And she's not afraid either. I never saw fear at all. She's the rock. I don't know what I'll do without her.
Celebrities often have a self-sacrificing partner and calm, coping children. What we don't hear about is the disintegration of relationships, the denial of death, and the confusion for children.
So she was just so angry with me. And even now, I think some of the things that she said at the time, I will never forgive you for saying that. And I'm not sure that I ever did. After she'd said all these things, I went, oh, well, you know, I'll just leave and, you know, the state health system will sort of move in and she'll get taken off to hospital and that'll be that, and I just won't have anything more to do with her, which is sort of what I was thinking.
The first time I had cancer, the girlfriend I was with, we'd been arguing anyway, and she sort of kicked me out, which was quite, I thought, callous, but I guess she couldn't deal with it at the time. So that was quite funny, actually. I got cancer and got kicked out of home.
When I was home, I wouldn't wear the wig, and some of his friends had seen me then and started teasing him about it. But look, they were kids too. They didn't understand, but, you know, it was hard enough for Oscar, let alone being teased about something that was completely out of his hands and mine also. It made it hard for him. And he, of course, was very angry with me then for looking the way I did, and he didn't want me to take him to school. There was a year I think he was in complete limbo and we didn't pick that up for a while.
My younger daughter, who was 12 when Angela died, she just denied it till the end. She never thought Angela was going to die, even though we sat down. I got them brought home from school to sit down with Angela in the room and say, while I said, you know, Mum is not going to get any better. In fact, what's going to happen is Mum's going to die. Mum's going to die quite soon, and so these are the things we're doing about it. And in fact, I did things like I bought them both presents, which were from Angela to them, which sort of Angela gave to them, to say, these are presents I'm giving to you because I'm going to die, and so I won't be here, so this is the last present I'll give to you. So we did things like that, which were designed to kind of make it real that this was what was happening. And Sally said that afterwards, that when Angela had died, she thought it was incredibly unfair because no one had ever said to her that there was any possibility of her mother dying, that people must have known she was dying, and no one said a thing to her. And the first time it ever occurred to her that there was a possibility of her dying was when I walked out and said, "Mum's dead."
The language of battle makes it hard to accept defeat. My aunt stayed determined and strong. Once, after losing her hair, she turned up in a Marilyn Monroe wig, laughing, but the joke fell flat. We had lunches where relatives came long distances, and we talked about everything except the fact that she would die. A week before she died, in hospital, with an oxygen mask on, she still had a pile of books by her bedside with titles like "You Can Beat Cancer." Her battle meant that I could never say goodbye.
When did she realise that she wasn't going to live 10 years? Or did she never realise?
That seems weird, but we had to actually get someone from outside to kind of mediate it, in a sense. She went in and started and just said, "You know, I've known you before and you've had a good life, and now is the point where you know that, you know, you're dying, and that what you have to do is you need to do that with grace. There's no point in just fighting against it." So that was a really good thing to have done, because otherwise we would have gotten to this thing where we just would have gone on and on and on and on and on, and I'd be there saying, "Oh, I think you're a lot better now," and you know, that'd be the last thing I would have said to Angela. "Oh, gee, you're looking better today."
I know when I was first diagnosed with the brain tumour, I was in the emergency department, RPA, for hours and hours. And while I was there, there were so many drug addicts and alcoholics there who didn't even know their name or where they were or what they were doing. I'm sitting there with my husband thinking, you know, I've got two kids to bring up, I've got a job, I've got a life I love, and I'm going to die, and then here's all these people around me who wouldn't even know who they were or where they were or what they were doing. I'm thinking, why? Why is it me? Why isn't it one of them? And I know that's a fruitless thought, but that's what was going through my mind at the time. And I suppose deep down that, you know, that's what does worry me and upsets me. But there's nothing you can do about it. For whatever reason, I got it.
We like to hear about heroism, but we don't want to talk about defeat. We don't want to talk about death. And the medical system often finds it as difficult as the rest of us.
They don't say this. Like that, they don't say, which becomes obvious, "Oh, well, once you got to this stage, there's no point having the drug because that's, you know, it's not working." They just say, "Oh, no, look, the conditions of the trial are that if anything happens, you know, you can't be still on the trial." "Oh, okay, that's unfortunate." And they sort of, "Oh, okay, well, so, yeah, we just need to keep taking these things for pain and stuff like that, and really we probably won't do anything else, but maybe come back and in 4 weeks' time." I said, "Oh, so I should make an appointment for 4 weeks' time?" And the doctor said, "Well, yeah, you don't need to make it now. I'd just, you know, leave it." And I said, "Well, so what should I be doing, you know, what?" And the doctor said, "Well, I think you should get your wife's affairs in order." And I went, "Oh, okay." And I thought, hang on, we get all this code. What, you know, the code is, you could make an appointment. We should maybe see you in 4 weeks' time, but don't bother making an appointment, because why are we making the appointment?
when it's so hard to get the appointment at the hospital? Oh, we're not making the appointment because you mightn't be able to come to the appointment because you'll be dead.
Science has defined the enemy and given us an arsenal of weapons. Charities bring us in on the fight. Celebrity culture gives us heroes to aspire to, but we seem less prepared for death than ever before. If we don't battle, what are we left with? Is it just the uncertainty of living and dying? And is that uncertainty just too awful to face?
You don't beat cancer, you don't wail on cancer. I'm going to kick cancer's ass, you know. I don't think you beat anything in that regard. You just do the best you can and hope that you have some good fortune.
I've had a lot of time to come to terms with it and face my demons and, you know, make peace with the situation. And, yeah, I mean, that I suppose I've accepted it now. And any time I get any, you know, it is a bonus, really.
In Cancer as a Battleground, you heard the voices of Kate Marne, Stuart Matchett, Rob McHugh, Professor Miles Little from Sydney University's Centre for Values and Ethics in Medicine, and Dr. Frank Bennett from St. George Hospital in Sydney. It was produced by Sophie Townsend, with technical production by Judy Rapley. Do you feel that the idea of a war on cancer is useful or right? Perhaps you or someone close to you has had cancer, and you've got your own ideas about the battle metaphor. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Just head to the 360 Documentaries website and click on Add Your Comment.